This program is brought to you by Three's Brewing, a Brooklyn-based brewery making beers you'll want to revisit over and over again, carefully crafted and gladly shared. Visit Three's at 333 Douglas Street in Gowanus, or learn more at threesbrewing.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Good evening and welcome to
Fomet About It
on HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
I'm Mary Izett.
I'm Chris Kuzmi.
And I'm Rachel Jacobs.
And we're your weekly co-hosts through this journey of all things fermented.
Archived on Stitcher, iTunes, and right here on HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
Which brings me to, are you a Heritage Radio Network member yet? Membership not only supports the production and broadcast of this show, but it also comes with some perks. One of the newest ones is a brand new members-only happy hour series called Books and Brews. The first one will be on April 12th at Three's Brewing. It's actually the Three's Brewing pop-up, which is at Franklin and Kent in Greenpoint, with host of Eat Your Words, Kathy Irway, and her new book, The Food of Taiwan. You'll get to meet more other members and hosts, snag a signed copy of The Food of Taiwan, and enjoy some beer from HRN business member Three's. Go to heritageradionetwork.org/donate and donate to get your exclusive invite today.
That's going to be a really cool party and a really cool hang, because I'm really curious about the space that they're doing it in. It's a new space that's specifically set up for these different pop-up events, and Threes is one of the first to take up the space. Right?
Yeah, and if you never ventured out to Gowanus and you want to try Threes,
oh, no, this
stuff,
is at Greenpoint.
Good.
Yeah, right. If you were camping, exactly.
Yeah, if you weren't able to venture out before and you live somewhere like Greenpoint, Williamsburg, and this is a good chance to try stuff at Threes. They have some of the greatest stuff brewing in Gowanus. And that's saying a lot, because there's a lot of stuff in Gowanus.
Oh, man. Yes. Yeah. And Greg Dorowski is a veteran in the industry, making some really, really great beer. Speaking of beer, you know who else is making a lot of great beer? A lot of you here in the United States. And I want to thank everybody who helped us for the National Homebrewers Competition first round judging and stewarding that we held over the weekend and at Kings County Brewers Collective. First of all, thank you, Kings County Brewers Collective, for hosting us, letting us do it there. Thank you especially to Harley Levine, the judge coordinator, handling a lot of judges and organizing all these people to judge 714 entries that showed up. And then also Daily Crafton as our cellar master, organizing it in the back end, and everybody who lent their palettes and their time to pull it off. We did it. And it was awesome.
There's so many bottles.
Indeed.
This Saturday, April 1st, is the Spring Craft Beer Festival at Belmont Racetrack. So if you are in Long Island or New York City and you want to head out to that. National Homebrewers Conference registration is ongoing. I'm staring at Chris like he's going to say something. So National Homebrewers Conference is the annual conference of the American Homebrewers Association. It's amazing. It will be in June, and registration is open now.
And you can go to homebrewcon.org to register to be there for that.
And then last but not least, Savor, which is the Brewers Association's big food and beer pairing event in Washington, D.C. every year, is June 2nd and June 3rd. And tickets are now on sale for that as well.
At savorcraftbeer.com. you gotta tell them where to do this.
That's good.
Gotta get into the Monday rhythm.
We know it's happening. But I don't know. If you're listening to the show, you found us somehow. The Google machine is out there.
Yes.
And I'm pretty sure that our listeners know of it. I'm really excited. Do you have any announcements?
I don't.
How was the Coffee and Tea Festival?
Oh, so yeah, I went to the Coffee and Tea Festival last week. It was Sunday, and it was really great. All sorts of fun coffees and teas going on there. There were some good kombucha vendors as well. And the lovely mushroom farmers who actually make that mushroom tea and hot chocolate that we've had on Heritage before were there too, and they were real excited to they they're real excited about that stuff upcoming on the network. So it was really cool.
And I know I didn't get to go to this one because I had my stomach was not happy that weekend. But there is an iced tea and coffee festival coming up in June, I think at the same space. So.
That's right. And it's all
be awesome.
Put together by our friends at Starfish Junction.
Yeah. Andy Calamano. Andy Linda Calamano. Great.
Yeah. Cool. Who, as you know, put together the Firm Fest as well, the New York City Firm
Fest. That's right.
Yeah. So they are pretty great.
What are we doing today, Mary?
All right. So in the world of fermentations, there's a lot. We've covered some things multiple times, like kombucha. Obviously, we have beer brewers on. There are actually a few things at which we, I think, have not even talked about at all. And one of those is shochu.
Shochu.
Which we're going to hear all about today. So I had met Stephen Lyman, who is our guest tonight, through another friend of ours. And you are the Cool Japan Ambassador. I'm going to totally butcher this. For Hankaku?
Pretty close. Hankaku.
Shochu and Certified Shochu Advisor, Sake School of America. You also have a website and you schedule all kinds of events in New York City. So welcome.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
So... Yeah.
How did you get here? Tell us about. I mean, you know, that train,
besides the L train.
Besides the L train,
yes.
Yeah. I mean, what? Yeah. How did you meet Mary at this other? At her, how did you get there? All of it.
Sure. So
why are you into it?
Mary and I met through Jeff Cialetti, who mm-hmm. wrote a great book, The Year of Drinking Adventurously, and he does have a chapter on shochu.
And we have had him on the show.
Yeah. Well. Yeah.
And he actually went to Japan with me 2 years ago for a shochu tour. We took journalists from around the world to visit distilleries down in southern Japan in Kyushu, mm-hmm. Which is where most shochu is made. But my discovery was really completely by accident on a Tuesday night in Chelsea. We were out with friends drinking probably too much wine at Teopole. We wanted another drink. There's this little Japanese bar next door. We walk inside. We sit down. The waitress says, "It's Tuesday. So that means shochu. It's shochu Tuesday. So it's $20 off a bottle." And I said,
"How much are bottles regularly?"
It varies, but usually between 40 and 120 approximately. So I looked at the menu, and you could get a bottle of shochu for $18 that night. This was a few years ago. And I said, "What's shochu?" And she said, "It's like Japanese vodka," which is an absolutely terrible description.
What is shochu?
The only thing it shares with vodka is that it contains alcohol and it's clear most of the time.
Okay.
So shochu is a distilled spirit from Japan. It can only be single distilled, which is what makes it different from vodka and most other spirits traditions. If you distill it more than once, it's no longer honkaku shochu. It's still taxed as shochu, but it's a different tax category, and it changes the labeling and everything in Japan, which most of us can't read, so we wouldn't know anyway.
Does it get called something else then?
Right.
Yeah, so there's actually multiple distillation came to Japan in the early 20th century, and they wanted to promote modernization, so they actually called that kotori shochu, which means kind of like improved shochu or better shochu, and otsuri shochu is like the old stuff, which is now honkoku, which people actually prefer because that's what connoisseurs drink, right? That's where all the flavor and nuance and aroma and everything is.
Yeah.
So when it's distilled again, is it?
You're basically stripping.
You're stripping
more
it of all the flavor, but it's not always smooth because there's more alcohol heat or.
Right. Exactly. Right. I mean, most of the kotori shochu now is being put into canned chuhais, which are basically like sodas and with alcohol in them. They're
kind of like shochu coolers.
Exactly. Okay, they're essentially shochu coolers. And a lot of Japanese people don't even realize that chuhais contain shochu. They just know that they have alcohol in them, but they don't really think about where that alcohol comes from. But that's kotori shochu. That's the multiply distilled kind. The single distilled shochu, which I brought for you guys to try today, is very carefully regulated by the Japanese government and the Shochu Makers Association to maintain their traditions and keep those distilleries operational.
How long has shochu been made?
Probably around 600 years. It's believed to have come through a trade route through Korea to Kyushu, which is where most shochu is made. They're pretty close to each other if you look at a map. And the fishermen between the two countries would interact quite a bit on some of the islands in the Sea of Japan. It's believed originally that the Japanese fishermen were buying distilled spirit from Koreans, and then they realized, why don't we just figure out how to make it? Mm-hmm. And they brought over stills, and they started to make it. That's somewhat speculative. There's no written history 600 years ago from that time about shochu, but that's the prevailing belief.
So you were in this Chelsea bar. You got $20 off of a bottle of shochu amongst your friends. Your friends hadn't had it either, right?
One of them had. The rest of us hadn't.
And was there a wide variety of shochu to choose from?
They probably had 20 or so on their list, which is a good selection.
That's more than most places in New York City.
Absolutely. Yeah, I actually didn't realize what good a selection it was.
Right.
But I tried a really light barley shochu the very first time, which actually is a great introduction because it's not overpowering. It doesn't taste weird. We drink barley alcohol all the time with whiskey and beer, so that wasn't really strange for me. But then there are other styles that become more challenging if you haven't tried shochu before, but then you start to like them. And so over over 6 months or a year, I sort of tasted through everything that they made or that they served at that bar. And then I started to look for other places around New York that sold shochu and found other places that have even bigger selections and tasted through everything in New York and then decided, well, I want more.
No. Was that first experience a revelatory experience? Like, have you had other things like it? I mean, it's clearly not like vodka, but did you fall in love with it with that?
It's hard to remember if I fell in love with it immediately, but I liked the discount, and I love Japanese food, so that was an easy sell. I also, at the time, was really doing a lot with pairing wines with food. I was really curious about that. I wasn't, not in any professional capacity, it was just something I enjoyed doing, going to French, Italian, Spanish restaurants, and figuring out what wines went with what kinds of food. And I realized shochu, because it's lower proof, it's actually diluted after distillation, pairs really well with food. So having a distilled spirit that pairs with food was revelatory for me.
Awesome. It's awesome.
Now, forgive my ignorance about shochu. When I was first introduced to it, I was told that it was kind of a milder, like a Japanese vodka, but milder, and it was just made from sweet potatoes. Now, I remember you were on a Akiko show back like last year, episode 23 or something, and you guys were talking about how shochu can be made from basically anything. Can you talk a little bit about like how shochu is made and like what makes it shochu if it's made from all these different things?
Sure. So there are actually three primary rules for shochu. We touched on one already, which is it has to be single distilled. You can't distill it more than once. Another thing is it has to be made with koji. And since this is fermented about it, we should probably talk about koji.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Although I'm going to save that. The other thing is what it's made from. There are actually 52 qualified ingredients to make shochu. Only two of them are fermentable sugars. They really try to keep away from fermentable sugars because of what koji does. But there are two exceptions. Many Japanese people think sweet potato is the only thing you make it from. But that's just the most predominant style.
And that's also true in Korea as well, right? I mean, we've been to Korean restaurants and had a distilled sweet potato.
I'm not sure how much I should say about Korean soju, but It's actually largely not made from sweet potatoes anymore. Yeah. Traditionally, it was.
Okay.
But the modern Korean soju is actually mass-produced ethanol that's then has additives and sweeteners and things like that.
You shattered my perceptions.
Palatable.
But traditionally,
traditionally.
So it sounds like that Japan has kept up the tradition more so.
That's right. Now, Japan had an advantage in that they were never conquered, and they also didn't have the kind of famines that Korea did in the recent past. And the Korean government actually made it illegal to make alcohol out of rice at a very inopportune time. And because of the rice famine that they were having. And obviously they were trying to save the population, but they ended up destroying their traditional Korean soju distillation tradition. And that's just now slowly being rebuilt. So there are now some very nice Korean sojus. They're actually much more in the style of a Chinese baijiu than they are Japanese shochu. So the two have divided quite a bit.
Interesting.
Anyway, getting back to the ingredients, there's all sorts of things you can make it from. Usually grains or root vegetables. So tubers, potatoes, different kinds. There's actually 500 varieties of sweet potatoes in Japan.
Wow.
About 50 of those are used in shochu production currently. There's 100 species of rice. A lot of those are used in shochu production. There's lots of different species of barley. A lot of those are used in shochu production. But then they use really weird things too, like kudzu. You know, roots of the kudzu plant.
What we consider invasive in the South.
That's right. Those are actually fermentable. The roots of the kudzu are fermentable. So you can actually make shochu out of kudzu.
Wow.
It's very sort of vegetal, as you can imagine.
Yeah.
But anyway, so there's all sorts of styles that you can have. The most dominant by far is sweet potato. Second is barley. A distant third is rice. And then all the rest at this point are pretty much novelty. Although soba has a following and some people really like chestnut shochu.
Oh, wow.
That's cool.
That's fun.
Where do you typically find shochu? Let's talk about like the shochu culture, I guess, in Japan and then also in America.
Okay. So it's interesting because shochu is almost all made in Kyushu, which is a large island at the south end of Japan. If you look at a map of Japan, it's basically the last big island. And the reason that they made shochu in Kyushu was it was too hot to make sake, but they still wanted to drink. And that had to do with koji. Yellow koji, which is used for virtually all sake production, is it has really floral aromatic notes, but it doesn't create much acid, which means you have to ferment at a low temperature in order to keep other organisms from infiltrating the mash, okay, or the fermentation. So black and white koji, which are used in shochu production predominantly, create a lot of acid, and that keeps the other organisms at bay, so you can ferment at higher temperatures in warmer climates. And then, but because of all that acid, you don't want to drink it directly like you would a sake, which is essentially you press the mash, and that the liquid that comes out of that is your sake. With shochu, you then distill it to take away the acidity.
Very cool.
How long, I mean, how big are shochu plants? Like, how much do people make a lot at a time? How long is it from grain to glass?
Sure. So I actually, every fall, work in one of the smallest distilleries in Japan, and they produce about 40,000 liters a year. One of the largest makers makes around 250,000 liters a day.
That's
so an enormous scale of difference between the two.
Sure.
And both of them are considered honkaku shochu. It's just one of them is essentially an industrial factory that has figured out how to grow koji reliably using heavy machinery. And the other place, at the other end of the spectrum, is still all being done by hand.
So. And also, I know some of the sake makers, it's a family business. Is that also true with shochu?
Yes, most shochu makers are actually family businesses.
Okay.
There are about 600 active shochu makers in Japan, virtually all of those in Kyushu. Some sake makers do distill their sake to make rice shochu, but a lot of that is actually just for tourists to visit the local areas because some people like to drink shochu rather than sake.
Hmm. Very interesting.
Awesome. We're going to take a really quick break and come back on Fermentabot, episode 197.
This episode is brought to you by Threes Brewing, a Brooklyn-based brewery known for creating drinkable craft beers that balance complexity and simplicity with a focus on lagers, farmhouse ales, and hop-forward American ales. Threes Brewing makes beer that's good, not just interesting or different. Beer that can be enjoyed without jostling for your attention. Beer that you'll want to revisit over and over again. The brewery itself, located at 333 Douglas Street at the intersection of Brooklyn's Borum Hill, Park Slope, and Gowanus neighborhoods, is a brew pub serving beers from the Threes portfolio and other top breweries, as well as cocktails and wine. While you're there, you can grab a sandwich from the Meat Hook or coffee from 9th Street Espresso. In the evenings, look for live music shows in Tiny Montgomery and a rotating series of DJs in the main bar. The brewery at Threes is a community space where friends can come together and strangers can become friends, or just drink Constant Disappointment IPA. Visit Threes Brewing at 333 Douglas Street in Brooklyn or their outpost in Greenpoint. Learn more at threesbrewing.com.
Welcome back to episode 198, not 197, of Fermentabot About It here at In Bushwick, Brooklyn.
The back of Roberta's.
We are here with Stephen Lemon, and we're talking about shochu. And we'd like to talk more about koji and how things are made with koji and
but
what happens.
First, we're going to... He just poured us a shochu. Now, I have virtually no experience with this beverage, and I wanted to come to the shochu's day that you had. And then we had the New York City Brewers Guild meeting, which I had to go to. But take us, first of all, tell us what this is, and then take us through how it's drank and how you kind of think about it.
All right. So the first shochu we'll taste is actually called Yufuin, which is the name of a town near the distillery in Oita Prefecture, which is the onsen prefecture. So the hot springs where people take warm baths and...
Where the snow monkeys are?
So Kyushu is hot, so they don't have snow monkeys.
Okay.
They do have other monkeys.
Regular monkeys.
Yeah, they have regular monkeys. But they don't come in the onsen with you because it's warm already. But so Yufuin actually is only available in two places in the world. One is in Yufuin. This brand is only available in that town or in New York City. So it's a special product from Yatsushika brewery. They're actually primarily a sake brewery, but they also make shochu. Oita is in the north of Kyushu, so that you can make sake in the mountains,
okay.
And so because it gets cooler there. And so this is one of their popular shochus. It's made with barley, and it's made with white koji. And then another aspect that I didn't touch on before is in Japan, they've started using vacuum stills, which vacuum stills are actually developed for perfume production, mm-hmm. right? To get the really, really light, subtle nuance out of botanicals. Mm-hmm. And so you get really different aromas. This is actually made to vacuum still.
We have a friend who has a vacuum still here mm-hmm. in New York City.
Yes, he's excited about doing it. He does it very well. And he says he's not into historical reenactments, which is why he doesn't distill in the traditional ways.
But that's cool. Right. So
this is actually a vacuum still white koji barley shochu. And white koji actually was developed in a laboratory at Kyushu University about 100 years ago. And before that, all koji was black. And koji is an ancient mold. And when you think about drinking mold, it doesn't sound very good. But in fact, koji is amazing. What it does is it converts starches into sugars so that the yeast can convert sugars into alcohol. And primarily only in sake and shochu production is it multiple parallel fermentation. So both processes are happening at the same time.
I know. So we've talked about koji before in reference to miso, as well as last time Rob Handel was here, he talked about how they dry age, how some restaurants are using it to kind of imitate dry age meat. Anyway, but we know a little bit about koji.
So the white koji is much more mild, and it tends to give you light sweet flavors, as opposed to black koji, which tends to be much earthier and rich, and a little bit wild. So the other shochu from that distillery that I have for us to taste, and it's probably too soon to taste another one, is made with black koji and using an atmospheric still, so using a traditional pot still. And you'll see completely different flavor characteristics, essentially from the same base ingredients.
So how take us through first of all, what kind of glassware? So we're drinking it in kind of these little mini white, they're like a beer sampler glass, but they're shaped like a white wine glass.
Right,
what's a proper glassware that you would typically find?
So unlike sake or green tea ceremonies in Japan, there's absolutely no tradition around shochu. You just drink it as you like it because it's in the south, and it's traditionally a blue collar beverage among like rural Japanese. And so, but typically you would drink it if you're doing a formal tasting or sampling, you would drink in something like this because you want to hold in the aromas, especially these light aromas. If you have an open glass, those are going to blow off pretty quickly. Where in this, you can actually hold them inside a little bit longer and catch some of those scents.
Just broke all my perceptions about shochu. It's not made of sweet potatoes. There's no ceremony around it.
So let's talk. So white koji, black koji, do they like specific mediums? Are there different strains of those kojis that are better for sweet potatoes and versus grains? And
they're completely happy with just about anything. Koji will just grow. And the master distiller I work with likes to say koji is honest, meaning he knows when he's like actually paid attention to the koji and done a good job, because he does it by hand, right? He knows that he's put in the time and the effort and the care to make good koji by how his fermentation comes out, because it all hinges on the koji being able to convert all the starches or as many of the starches as possible into sugars.
And he repitches koji? He takes the koji off of old batches to put onto new ones? Or
no, he actually always uses new koji.
Always uses new koji.
Being a koji producer would be a full-time job. It's not something that you would do in your brewery or your distillery.
Gotcha.
He will reuse yeasts because he wants a little bit of the wild yeast. He uses open fermentation, actually. And he does use a little yeast that's from the guild as well to get the first fermentation started, but then he will add some from the previous day's fermentation to keep things going.
Interesting.
Yeah, so take us through how this is made, kind of how it looks and feels, I guess.
Sure. So traditionally, and virtually all of my experience has been in traditional distilleries, which are the handmade distilleries, you start by making your koji, you wash the rice, you steam the rice, and then you have to cool it down to about a little above body temperature. before adding the koji spores, because the koji is alive, and if the rice is too hot, they'll just die.
And are they using like a polished rice or a particular type of rice, if they're using rice?
It's polished. In this distillery, it's polished Japanese rice.
Okay.
That's right. So, and then you spread the koji spores, and then you hand mix, and you get it down to about body temperature, about 36.8 degrees Celsius. And then you put all the koji in a big mound on this table, and then you wrap it in blankets and you put it in the koji room, which is high humidity, high temperature, and you let it rest for essentially overnight. Next morning, you wake it up. And
high temperature being like...
you want to keep the koji below about 42 degrees Celsius. If once it gets up to about 40, 41, that's when you'll break it and you'll cool it. And you also aerate it when you're doing that, because koji loves oxygen. So you want to give it as much oxygen as possible to get it activated again. But that goes on for about 2 days, where you keep the koji and you're breaking it and you're moving it around and you're waking it up and you're putting it back to bed. And then you break it up and you put it in these smaller boxes, and the boxes give it more oxygen and keep it cooler, because it's really starting to overheat at this point.
Because it's producing its own heat, I'm sure.
That's right.
As a brewer, is there a point when the oxygen becomes bad, or you've gotten what you wanted and you no longer want to be introducing oxygen to it?
Once you're introducing yeast to the fermentation. Okay. Yep. That's when the oxygen becomes helpful. But with koji loves oxygen.
Dig it.
So after about 2 days, you're going to have white, fluffy rice. Traditionally, in this distillery, they've used white koji for the last, essentially since it's been developed. Black koji, they'd be fuzzy with like dark gray. And it's dry. The rice is dried out at this point because it's basically sucked all the moisture out of it. You then dump all that koji into the first fermentation tank, which is usually about a 400 to 500 liter clay pot buried in the floor of the distillery. And then you add water and yeast, and you stir it. And then it ferments that way for about a week, and you just want to maintain temperature. And part of the reason you do the stirring is to get the koji some more oxygen as it comes to the surface. But you also want to stress the yeast. A stressed yeast actually gives you different aromas than if you're not stressing the yeast.
Like produces different flavor and aroma compounds.
Mm-hmm. That's right. And so then after a week, approximately, you would then take whatever your base ingredient's going to be, one of those 50 plus ingredients, and you would process it. So at the distillery I work, it's sweet potatoes. So you wash the sweet potatoes, and then you trim the sweet potatoes, because the ends are bitter and you don't want a bitter shochu. So you trim the ends of the potato, and then you're looking for dead spots. And then those go into a steamer. They get washed a second time and then into a steamer. And as they come out of the steamer, they're ground up. And that's going into the second fermentation tank. And so you add everything from the first fermentation to this larger fermentation tank. More water, more yeasts, and then stirring, essentially, for about 10 days.
So 10 days.
Yeah. And these are all open fermentation tanks.
Does the koji always start with rice?
Usually.
Okay.
Koji traditionally was rice.
Right.
It's now available. There's now barley koji, which I believe this is 100% barley shochu, the one that we're trying now.
Fabulous.
Yeah, that's the style really nice, in Oita.
So this is, I feel like I have to describe it, because I think a lot of people haven't, you know, it's not, I mean, New York City, we're very lucky. We have a lot of Japanese restaurants and we have access to, you know, all kinds of alcoholic beverage get imported here that don't go to other places. But this is a very like delicate, smooth, I mean, that's how, has some floral characters. It's really nice. We're drinking it in these little glasses with no ice. It's very smooth. It's delicious.
What is the alcohol percentage on this?
This one's 20%.
20%.
Which Oita and Miyazaki, the east side of Kyushu, they tend to do 20%. The rest of Kyushu is usually 25%.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's refreshing too. So anyway.
I'm glad you like it. Are we ready to try the next one?
Sure. Mm-hmm.
This will move us to black koji. Traditionally, they would have been drinking black koji out of atmospheric still. So the next one we're going to try is actually much closer to a traditional shochu, which what we're drinking now is much more modern style.
That was the sound of all of us sipping simultaneously. It was like...
then we're going to talk about... So the soji's here... Shochu. Embrace that word, shochu. The shochus here you can get at Japanese restaurants.
Go ahead. Sorry, we're having some pouring difficulties.
Izakaya. So let's talk a little bit about where do people typically, like, is it common in Japan? I know we've talked about sake on the show and some of the other beverages. How common is it, and where do you find it?
Yeah, so primarily izakaya, but so the word sake actually means alcohol in Japanese.
Okay.
So if you order sake in an izakaya in Kyushu, you're getting shochu.
Okay.
That's their local drink, so that's what they'll give you. If you order sake in most of the rest of Japan, you're getting nihonshu, which is the fermented rice beverage
that we know as sake.
That we know as sake.
That's okay.
Right. So, but primarily shochu is available in almost ubiquitous in izakaya around Japan. You can also find it in other styles of restaurants. It's actually really popular in udon and soba restaurants. If you're going there for dinner, it often becomes a drinking session. And so it's available there. And just really any bar in Japan will have it.
So why don't we talk about what an izakaya is? So, because I never experienced an izakaya until probably like 10 years ago in New York City.
Okay, so izakaya technically means sit sake shop. Before the first izakaya, you would go to the sake maker and you would buy your sake and you'd take it home. And then they realized, oh, we can serve food and people will stay and they'll drink more and they'll eat more and they'll pay more. So that's how izakaya started. But it's really meant for like alcohol-forward dining. So you tend to have a large group of friends get together. You order most of the menu and you just drink to your heart's content. And 2 or 3 hours later, you stumble home.
It's kind of tapas style, right? They're all like shared small plates.
That's right. A small place meant for sharing. And there's really a rhythm to it. You know, an izakaya, you can kind of course it out where you start with some lighter beverages and some lighter food. And then you move into medium bodied and then you get richer and richer. And then you finish with what's called shime, which is essentially like noodles or rice to fill you up and soak up some of the alcohol. Kind of our idea of having a late night slice.
Mm-hmm. What are some of your favorite places in New York City?
In New York. So for shochu selection, I don't think any place beats Uminoye, which is a tiny little hole in the wall in the East Village. They've been there for years. They have an amazing shochu selection, but they're a little bit opaque for foreigners. Like their website's in Japanese and the staff's Japanese, and take it or leave it. You know, they're not really catering to.
But I guess
English
if you went there and didn't speak Japanese, you would still be able to. You could be served.
Right.
I mean, it would just be more
a
of a
challenging
guessing
navigation
game.
to resolve.
Lots of
that's
Google.
Right. That's right. And their menu is pretty simple. So it's not really a place I go for a meal. It's a place I'll go for like a second stop.
Okay.
After having a meal, I go there and have a couple drinks and a couple snacks. And Japanese always eat food with drinks. The concept of a bar where you don't have food is just like almost completely foreign. It's considered like a Western bar if you do that in Japan.
Yeah. And where else? What are
so Sakamai in the Lower East Side also has a great shochu selection. They also have a full menu, and their chef is from Miyazaki, which is part of Kyushu. So his food just naturally goes well with shochu. In Midtown, there's Domburiya in Hell's Kitchen has a nice shochu selection, and then Soba Toto on the East Side in Midtown. The place I went to in Chelsea used to be called Izakaya Ten. It's now called Juban. They have a nice shochu selection still. And then in Brooklyn, a couple of the nice places closed. Actually, 108, which is a sushi restaurant in Williamsburg.
That's very close to where we live.
Has a nice shochu selection. They often have things that just aren't available anywhere else. So they're nice place.
This with the black
koji. This is completely
this
different animal.
So different.
Yeah.
So... It's a lot more aromatic.
I feel like it smells more umami-ish.
Right.
Yeah, it smells a little more like a bread or a wheat or something.
And is that a product of the koji, or is that a product of perhaps more stirring in there and getting more from the yeast? And do they typically use the same yeast selection for these things once they get to that part of the stage?
So most shochu uses pretty simple yeasts.
Okay.
They're not too creative with yeast for main brands. But especially in rice shochu, they'll play around with yeast quite a bit because in rice shochu, you get a lot of the floral notes from yeast. So they're actually using a lot of flour yeast. They use a lot of sake yeasts, yeasts that are used for sake production. Shochu yeasts tend to be relatively neutral unless you're going for a specific flavor profile. So a lot of the flavor and character you're picking up is from the koji. That umami is something koji, I associate with black koji. Oh.
So you said that that the white koji was originated and was lab grown, right? Lab created. So where does this come? This is a more traditional koji?
Yeah, this koji has been around for thousands of years. Like nobody knows where it really came from. It's actually designated as Aspergillus Awamori. And Awamori is Okinawan distilled liquor from around the same era as shochu. But it's a distinct distilling tradition from shochu. Although now Okinawa is part of Japan, so they're now under the same governmental class of alcohol, but they have their own rules and distilling like styles.
Mm-hmm. So it was probably, so it sounds like it was discovered and named from a distilled product or a...
Right, but that was from a modern interpretation, right? Because they didn't know what they were working
with.
They
just knew that, yeah.
They just knew that this mold would convert starches to sugars. Well, they probably didn't even know that that was happening. They know the end result was alcohol.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yep.
And the black koji actually is pretty wild. Like, if you're in a distillery that uses black koji, it's just all over the walls, just like black mold would be in a lot of places. So the white koji tends not to do that. In fact, when the distillery where I work, we did a black koji for 3 days as an experiment. And for the next week, as I was sweeping up the floor of the koji room, which invariably some rice ends up on the floor, even though we had switched back to white koji, the rice that would fall on the floor would be gray from the residual black koji that was still in the room.
So it sounds like it sticks around for longer. And interesting.
Yeah, koji is essentially like I'm blanking on the word. It'll live forever unless you like overheat it.
So you said they switched from black koji to white koji. How did they? They didn't sanitize or sterilize the room. They just kind of cleaned it, or how does that work?
The room was sterilized.
Oh, it was sterilized.
Yeah,
okay.
But you can't get a perfect sterilization right in one day with part-time staff.
How do they
still air?
How do they sterilize it with steam or?
I actually wasn't involved in that process.
That's curious. That's just sure. As brewers, you kind of
tends to be hydrogen. A lot of hydrogen peroxide in the cleansing process. A lot of water.
So you tell us. Well, first of all, tell us about. So you have a blog. That's great. You write a lot about shochu.
What's the blog?
And all kinds of stuff.
It's kampai.us. It's kampai.us. kanpai.us will also get you there. It's really meant as all things shochu. I don't update it as often as I used to, but that's because most of the brands available in the States are already represented there.
What is the meaning and what are the traditions that go along with it of kampai?
So kampai is actually, it's the Japanese version of cheers, and it means empty your glass. So why don't we have a kampai? we can try this last
year.
There
we go. See, that's kampai. Kampai. Empty your glass. So this is a... we did this in Macau and Guangzhou also quite a bit. And there was a thing where there was a hierarchy of when you cheers your glass, the most respected person in the room, you are supposed to make sure the lip of your glass is below his or her glass. So sometimes if you're of mutual respect, you end up in a kind of a battle. Everybody's trying to go lower with their thing. Then you just end up laughing, say, come high.
That happens in Japan as well. We end up sometimes like under the table on the exactly. floor trying to do it.
I think it's an interesting, fun little tradition.
So you are leaving for Japan.
Yes, on Thursday.
On Thursday. And what do you have planned?
I'm actually doing research for a couple of book projects. And I have... a few days in Tokyo when I arrive. Fortunately, some friends from New York are there concurrently, so we get to hang out. It'll be the cherry blossom season, and they have a great tradition known as hanami, which is it technically means flower. Look at flowers, look at the cherry blossoms, but it's just an excuse to drink outdoors at the beginning of spring, and it's like one of the best experiences in Japan. So, Chris Pellegrini, who actually wrote the first shochu, the English language shochu book, is throwing a hanami party the first weekend that we're there. So we're all going to go and sit under the cherry blossoms and drink shochu.
Where is this, on a park or?
This is in Yoyogi Park in central Tokyo.
Okay, cool.
So that'll be a lot of fun. And then it's down to Kyushu for about a month to do research, visit distilleries, pottery makers for traditional glassware and that sort of thing.
Only you can prevent forest fires.
And this also smells completely different than the first two that we had.
Yeah, so I'll finish my itinerary and then we'll get to this.
Yes.
So then a month in Kyoto, actually. I haven't spent much time there, but I have an opportunity to be a visiting professor at Kyoto University to do some research. And then after that, I've got a side trip to Shanghai for a conference, and then I'll be back in Japan for a couple of weeks just for R&R before coming back to the grind in New York.
Awesome.
So what we're trying now is actually...
This has a cherry blossom.
This is not available anywhere, probably really hard to find in Tokyo. And this is a sweet potato shochu from Miyazaki, from a really famous producer called Kuroki Honten. which makes actually the most famous barley shochu in Japan. But this is a sweet potato shochu, and this is their winter 2017 release. So this is actually what they call shinshu. So that means new shochu. So this wasn't aged. We didn't get into aging, but most shochu sits in a stainless tank between 3 and 6 months to blow off some of the esters and that sort of thing, some of the gases. This is bottled a couple weeks after distillation.
Then how long is a bottle of shochu good for? And does it age well?
So most shochu is just like any other distillate that's been filtered, and it's just clean, and it'll sit for years. I've had shochu that's 25 years old, and it just tastes like it was made, you know, last year. This one will not age well because it has a lot of residual oil in it because of the single distillation, which is part of the reason I brought it, because I don't want to leave this sitting on my shelf for 3 months while I'm in Japan.
Right.
Sure.
You guys may as well enjoy it. So
yeah, this is amazing too. I mean, these were all very different. I don't know which one I liked best, but
I'm just imagining what your checked baggage looks like coming back from Japan.
There's this great wine suitcase that'll actually carry 12 bottles in foam without going over the weight limit. And I'm pretty content with bringing back 12 bottles of great shochu at this point. But this shochu is pretty special. A lot of the distilleries that make this style will not sell it outside of Kyushu because they don't believe bartenders anywhere else know how to take care of it.
Because should be served, and it probably needs to be kept cooler?
I mean, cooling it will slow down the process because you don't want the oils to turn. Basically, you don't want the oils to go rancid. Mm-hmm. And I've definitely tried these where the oils have gone off. With this one, what you would do is when it's capped, what you'd want to do for storage is you just turn it probably once a week or so just to rinse the sides of the bottle.
Okay.
And it should keep for as long as you're willing to keep it around before you finish it. But if you just let it sit for a few months, it's gonna go off. Mm-hmm.
So if somebody is interested in trying some shochu and they haven't yet, what do you recommend? I guess find somewhere that has a pretty good shochu menu. Do most places have like tasting?
So let's go back to what was the name of the style of the first shochu that we had?
It's a barley shochu.
Did we just say barley shochu? Because that one was pretty. It was pretty tame. It was pretty subtle.
Yeah.
It was a beautiful intro, and then these other two have been more assertive in their flavors.
Right. Actually, the light barley is where I started. The very first shochu I bought, and it was partly price point. Right. Was called Ichiko, which is available almost ubiquitously around the United States.
Ichiko.
It's ubiquitous in Hawaii, but almost any place that serves shochu in the States is likely to have Ichiko. A very light, clean barley shochu. They actually do a lot of blending of both atmospheric pressure and vacuum still distillate to come up with more of a blended shochu, which can have really elegant aromas and flavors. So that's an easy one to start with. The products from this distillery from Yatsushika, which are Yufuin, and then they have one called Ginza no Suzume, which is Ginza no Suzume black. They make a Ginza no Suzume white, which is also nice and light and easy to drink. So those are very easy introductions. There's a rice shochu called Hakutaki Shiro, which essentially means white. And that's a very light, easy drinking rice shochu with really nice rice aromas. But I actually do Show Tuesday, which is a monthly happy hour.
Which I'm going to make next month.
To introduce shochu. Now, next month, I have a guest bartender.
Right.
But he actually had a shochu website before I did, so you'd be in good hands. But once a month, and you can check this out on kanpai.us, there's a shochu happy hour in New York City, really to introduce different styles of service or different styles of shochu. And we're always there to talk about it and think about it and really give a good introduction to people who are unfamiliar. And then hopefully introduce people who are familiar to new styles and ways of drinking it.
And if you're not in New York City, but your website is a great resource, especially if you're interested in, you know, maybe if your local liquor store carries shochu or Japanese restaurants.
And I would say if you live in a major city, like find me on Twitter. It's at KanpaiUS. It's pretty simple. And tweet at me. I found shochu in Dallas and Austin and all sorts of random places.
So. The website forwards itself, but your Twitter will not. So you're at Kempai with an M, right?
That's right, with an M, exactly.
Cool. Yep. Awesome. Thank you so much,
Steven,
for being
awesome.
On. This has been great.
I've learned a lot, and I'm truly inspired by these flavors and you.
Great. Yeah. Thank you. Please
enjoy
drink more
your
shochu.
Trip. Yes, definitely. Enjoy your trip. And please check out his website, Kampai, KAMPAI.US.
That's right.
Cheers.
Fermented about it.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.